I'd like to call the August 8th meeting of Lakeview Meetings to order. Can I have approval of July 11th and July 18th minutes?
Move it.
Second?
Second.
Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye, so carried. Resolution number 486. Can I have a motion?
I'll move it.
Second?
I'll second.
Discussion? There's a special meeting on Thursday, so can I get a motion to postpone?
I'll move the postpone for 1 week.
Second?
To the special meeting.
To the special meeting.
Second, Brian. Discussion? All those in favor?
We're gonna vote. The special. Fair enough.
Alright, resolution 330. Can I have a motion?
I'll move. Second.
Second? Discussion?
Well, I was about to move it, but somebody beat me to it.
Discussion? Chair Bartle?
Thank you. So, yeah, I'm just going through. So, I've had conversations with the sponsor, and I meant to have a conversation with the sponsor today and wasn't able, and also with the executive about this. You know, I voiced some of my concerns both at the level of the assignment in relation to our unrestricted fund balance policy and the ability to expend the funds, which is something that we're going to see over time, especially and particularly if we dedicate a certain amount of the bed tax to go directly to this fund, because it'll replenish the fund potentially at a rate that exceeds our ability to spend it. You know, I have some very specific concerns about the granting portion of the program, especially given what we've seen happen through ARPA and our ability to put out grants, although I really do appreciate the program guidance and the detail of the program guidance. And I think we're well on our way to potentially being able to deal with that. Some of the detail in terms of, and again, it's like I don't want to get totally into the weeds on this, because again, I appreciate the intent, and I concur that housing is an emergency on all levels in terms of affordability, emergency and temporary housing, et cetera. And this proposes dealing with it on a multi-pronged front. One of the things that I've been thinking about recently is the monitoring aspect of this, and I don't know if it's been talked about in the committees, but actually the level of work that's going to take to confirm over time as we're building up more and more units that those units are actually maintained and going to affordable housing projects. It's one thing when a project's deemed affordable housing, something like the Penrose project that we're talking about, where you have, it's under sort of strict guidelines. It's another when it's a owner-occupied project or an accessory dwelling project. That's something that we're going to in-house have to be making sure that we've given X amount of dollars to this project, and 12, 13 years later, who's in it and how do they verify that that person was eligible and are they maintaining the same rent and et cetera. So I don't know if that's been contemplated. I don't know if anyone can speak to what the proposal is for managing this long term, and whether or not what amount of staffing this is going to take. That's the follow-on question to that portion of it.
This did come up in economic development, and I think Director Doyle spoke to it.
We did, and I think Chair Guevara actually mentioned it at the last meeting as well. And the planning department is anticipating that as we move into this deeper and deeper, we would need additional staff, probably about a full-time position. Westchester County monitors about 4,000 units with one staff position. We won't get near 4,000 units for quite a while. The monitoring is not as difficult as it would seem, the detailed monitoring. So what you do is self-certification, and then you go in and you audit certain people that you have risks for. I will also tell you that we're building monitoring into some of our contracts. For example, the Affordable Rental Upgrade Program that the legislature put money in the county's budget for, we're building that monitoring into the contract with RUFCO so that they have a responsibility to monitor it for the affordability period. So that's another way to approach it.
Are you talking about, I'm sorry if I may, when you talk about the money that the legislature put in, you're talking about, is that the accessory dwelling units?
No, they put, the legislature put in $1.5 million as a budget addition at the end of last year for an affordable rental upgrade program.
Money for landlords to upgrade.
So we built that, monitoring into the project. The other question that comes up longer term, in addition to services that the county can think about, has to do with inclusionary zoning. A lot of municipalities are taking up our recommendations with respect to inclusionary zoning, and 10% of their new projects are required to be inclusionary. And so you can monitor those for the municipalities as well through a contractual agreement to do that, some of that work. So it's been thought about, it's been it's discussed, but where we are now, it's a little too soon to start to think about how much that monitoring is going to take place.
And if I can ask a follow on, I mean, to the earlier part of the concern, to the extent that if and when we run it, so if this is contemplating spending 20% of the assignment a year, it's I realize we're not actually locking the money with an assignment, but if the assignment is growing due to a commitment from bed tax and we're unable to expend the 20%, so if we start to see that the assignment is growing and that intersection is running against our own fund balance policy, what is contemplated? Releasing some of the assignment?
So there's a couple things I think that's out there. One is that the legislature has complete control relative to an assignment of funds or not assigning those funds so that you could release them to other uses. The other thing is that, you know, as I think we've discussed, there's some question with respect to what you want to do as it relates to emergency housing. The county can use a portion of this funds as it relates to emergency housing. Our discussions with other counties that have been involved in these types of funding, it has been that longer-term funding is what basically makes these programs successful, and the capacity or the amount of applications and requests for funding builds over time as developers begin and individuals begin to essentially contemplate moving this funding moving a portion of their capital stack into actual funding that's available. So when we talk to Tompkins County, et cetera, they've indicated to us that they now, when they started out, they didn't have the applications to essentially in terms of the money available. They've now exceeded the amount of money is available, and they're making decisions, very, very difficult decisions about what and what not to fund. So we would anticipate that within the time frame that you're contemplating, which is 3 years, that the popularity of the program and its need will continue to grow.
Senator Cahill?
Yeah, so I want to get back to, if you don't mind, through you to Dennis, the inclusionary zoning changes. So these would require local municipalities to change their zoning laws to have inclusionary aspects to new building, correct? Some have done it. I think Kingston has it.
We have quite a few. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Because that's kind of like, I want to get a really good idea of what kind of lift that is to, you know, convince other municipalities to include that in their zoning, change their zoning laws to have that in there so they can participate in these programs. Because if the local municipalities don't do that, they can't participate, right? And so now we are shutting out a large or whatever, a portion of the county from participating in this if they don't meet that guideline.
There would be, from my perspective anyway, there would be no reason not to allow municipalities to participate in this fund, even whether they have inclusionary zoning or they don't. It's not fundamental to the ability to participate. The inclusionary zoning discussion is one that comes up in the Housing Smart Communities program, and we've asked them to consider some of that. I will tell you that when you look around the county, it's not as unusual as you would think to have inclusionary zoning as part of a zoning statute. Lloyd, Village of New Paltz, the town of New Paltz is currently considering it. Marbletown, Saugerties, all of those areas already have inclusionary zoning, as obviously does the city of Kingston. It's not as big a lift as you would think. It really isn't. So I would think that number one is I would not expect that we would look at these things and say you're not entitled to essentially using this fund if you don't have inclusionary zoning. In point of fact, if communities aren't participating, one of the ways to essentially make sure that they participate in a fair share discussion in terms of pulling their weight with respect to affordable housing And this is the kind of discussion you hear in communities where the city of Kingston said, well, we're providing all the affordable housing and nobody else wants to participate, so why should we continue to provide affordable housing? So the thought being is that if there's an opportunity for to subsidize a developer in a good way with respect to communities that don't have inclusionary zoning, I would imagine that that would continue to fly in terms of the ranking system that's set up under the NOFA. It's not meant to be exclusionary to those people that don't participate either in the housing smart communities or particular zoning changes that we think are needed, but may not, the community may not.
So that wouldn't preclude the county from offering the grant and awarding the grant. However, if the town doesn't want it, right, as you stated, you know, Kingston, Ulster, Saugerties, New Paltz have done quite a bit as far as that aspect of low-income housing in the county, but yet there's a lot of other towns in the county that haven't. And so my question becomes, does it just mean that those folks would just, you know, continue to be the towns and the city that support all of this low-income housing throughout the whole county when it does absolutely generate in every single town in the county?
Excuse me,
that's Denny calling right now.
thank you. It probably is. No. The answer I would give you is that there may be sort of a general sense that we're not we don't want to participate in an issue with respect to inclusionary zoning, but there also may be a general sense that there are opportunities within the community to provide for affordable housing. And the best example, in my opinion, Legislator Cahill, is the one that you represent. The town of Ulster has been sort of resistant as it relates to some of the broader discussions as it relates to zoning changes. Mm-hmm. But when you look around the town of Ulster, they've provided a lot of affordable housing up by UPS, out in Seven Greens, the most recent one with respect to the project at the Quality Inn. So that those kinds of opportunities would give the county the ability to essentially help fund them. So I don't see that as saying that some communities won't meet their fair share. Maybe somewhat more difficult and somewhat less liberal as it relates to their housing policies. But I think there's opportunities within communities to do these types of things.
As far as oversight goes, it sounded like you referenced that we're doing it already to a point, making sure that, can you give us examples of who in county employee does the checking and what they do and
sure
paper trail of how they operate and do that?
So we essentially, through our community development block grant funds and through our other contracts, we essentially make sure that there's a monitoring provision in those contracts to do that. And then what we end up doing from a staff perspective, we pull various projects out of a sample and make sure that all of that paperwork is necessary. We also have in the past filed notes and mortgages, and that's what we're going to do with the Affordable Rental Housing Upgrade Program. We're going to file a lien so that there's a lien filed against the project, or against the owner, for those types of things. So that's enforceable not only with respect to the current owner, but also with respect to future owners as well. So we'll file a note mortgage for the time frame, and that's a common occurrence with respect to affordability.
So who does that now? And that's planning that does it?
No, we basically contractually file the notes and mortgage through RUPCO.
So we're trusting RUPCO to make sure everybody's in compliance.
Well, it's not necessarily a trust, it's a note mortgage, so that when the title searchers come in and look in terms of a transfer, they show up. And we have that fairly common when there's a sale, and then we recoup portions of that funding as program income.
So will RUPCO be doing it again this next time around?
So on certain projects, the answer to that would be yes. If it's direct county to an entity, we would probably recommend you file a note and mortgage. And
then we would be overseeing it.
Well, the private sector does a lot of the overseeing, particularly with respect to sales. So it's not, it's the we is everyone, it's a collective we.
But we'd need half a staff, you said at some point, but just to be a liaison to the private not-for-profit sector that's doing the checking?
No. I think what you end up doing is you start to say that how do you essentially assist the communities in order to make sure that these things get done, make sure that the county's interests are protected, and then make sure that you do the necessary audits. So think of this as an audit function, so that you do this. And the example I would give you is that the same types of things can happen with respect with your IDA and the pilot programs of the IDA. So they monitor jobs, et cetera, et cetera. So those things they're self-reporting. It's not as difficult as you think.
Okay. Well, I haven't seen a lot of. I've been pretty frustrated with the IDA. There's not been a lot of clawbacks, and I've actually had members of the IDA say it's in the hopper. We acknowledge that one's not going well, and we should claw back, but we don't. So it doesn't give me a lot of confidence. So we're not. But is there an example of this kind of oversight that we're doing now inside the county? I started out with that question.
And the answer is that it's inside the county as it relates to our contractual relationships. We do not monitor affordability as a county itself because we don't have any affordability programs that are not out there contractually with someone else.
Okay. We did just fund a complex in town of Lloyd, but so in theory it would be that kind of thing going into the future, and then we would be following up ourselves, or we're...
The low-income housing tax credit program fundings are monitored at the state level. They're overseen very, very rigorously at the state level. We would not see a need to essentially monitor those, at least in my opinion, relative to the state requirements, because they monitor them on a regular basis, both in terms of how they're leased out, how they fill vacancies, and also their rents. They are highly regulated.
Oh, I took the chair's question as Penrose as an example. They're guaranteeing us a certain amount of units are affordable at this rate, senior, and but we want to keep an eye to make sure they don't magically turn into market rate.
She was talking about smaller scale.
Yeah, what I was saying, if I can clarify, what I was saying is that my understanding is that in a project like Penrose, that's regulated at a higher level. So, but in the smaller type projects that are contemplated here, we're responsible for the regulation. So
more the ADUs.
Yeah, so in an ADU or a small one, if we're saying, okay, you're going to keep it affordable, we're going to give you X amount of dollars, but you're going to keep it affordable at this rate, and it's going to be eligible for tenants at this rate, who's going to verify that in 6 years, that actually it's still at that rate and that the tenants are still... eligible tenants. Who's going to follow up on the regular? And the answer that I understood was that it's going to be self-reported except for audits. Versus, I actually don't really have concern in a project like Penrose that those units are going
to
stay affordable.
Because
I don't know that it's that I trust the state per se, but I think they're very highly regulated in terms of the funding sources. So. I mean, I don't know. I could ask Planner Doyle or someone who else might have the information. But at that level of project, I suspect that there's quite a level of regulation that happens on the regular. I don't mean they have to keep it affordable for X amount of time, and they have to verify that it's affordable for X amount of time. I don't think it's
yeah.
This is much more.
What
this
is
much more loose.
What is the X amount of time with a state tax credit?
The federal tax credits, and there are also state tax credits as well, it's 30 years. It's 15 plus 15, so it's 30 years, and that's what we're expecting. I believe, without going back, and I believe Penrose is at 40 years.
Yeah, that's what they said.
Yeah.
Matches the length of the pilot, I believe.
Yeah.
Which brings me to my last question. As we're subsidizing developers on the small and large scale, this is something that I've brought up a lot. Does it concern us, or do we ever want to put anything in about the lottery, about pilots? If not for, how do we ensure we're not, Dennis, you told me the other day, I own rental properties. You said, in theory, I would be eligible if I wasn't a legislator for some of these funds, but I just did a large renovation. So had I known about this and I wasn't a legislator, guess what? I would have gotten a large percentage of that paid, and the renovation happened anyways. Same, always the question with the IDA, if not for, and what ends up happening, unfortunately, is people are, you can't blame them, they're up, the money's out there, and they go, and we end up funding something that was going to happen anyways. With the ADUs, at least, they're never going to have pilots, and they're going to pay school taxes, but as we start, and that's what we're talking about, getting into subsidizing developers in a big way, at some point, we have to be concerned about the school district and our educational system and the kids, and it just doesn't seem like we're thinking about that at all. Housing, 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 doesn't matter if we're moving the majority of the people in from out of county, doesn't matter if the school district's going to get much, but I don't see us acknowledging that as a real issue, and it is a real issue to me.
So it's not something that I contemplated in the specific, but I would imagine that that's something that could be put in here, not for the traditional affordable housing that would require, that have state and federal funding in the stack, that would require the lottery, but for some of these smaller projects, the ones you're talking about, the owner-occupied, the non-traditional, the accessory dwelling units. I mean, I suspect we could put that language into here. I mean, some of the language in here, and I don't know if it's intentional, does concern me because there's language that says should. Like when you talk about affordability requirements, you know, it says that they should be able to ensure that housing units are affordable for over the long term, and that they should be retained through a set of mechanisms, not that they shall. And I don't know if that's intentional, but and I don't know if those
can
are things.
Can we change it? Can we amend that right now? Shall
or must?
Well,
I would assume, but I'm saying that that's something that for those smaller things could be considered. My understanding in terms of the lottery, and Penrose didn't speak to it when Penrose was here, but that the lottery, at least in the last time that I saw them, they said that in their experience, a high percentage of lottery goes to local people because typically a high percentage of local people, are you saying, shaking your head, no?
That's not the conversation I had with them, but mine was longer ago than that.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, my understanding is, at the time they said that a high percentage tend to go to local people because it tends to be local people who are applying for the local projects, not the full, people want to live near where they are. But again, we're not covered by federal and state stacks on accessory dwelling units.
Yeah.
So.
So there's opportunity there to add language.
There is opportunity to add language.
With some trepidation, I just want to remind everyone that there is a fair housing law in the land that basically says that you can't discriminate or have the or your policies have the impact of discrimination. Yep. So we need to be very, very careful in terms of adding language and putting landlords and others in jeopardy with respect to being in violation of the fair housing statutes. And that those are strict, and there's something we need to be concerned about.
What have we discussed that would be discriminatory?
Well, if you're going to put a preference, for example, on individual landlords, that they can only rent to people that are essentially from Ulster County. Mm-hmm. If you have
New
an apartment
City's
open
able
up.
To do, New York City's able to do that. It's not considered discrimination.
So,
and the only reason I'm told we can't do it on the state level is because it's state funds with these tax credits that we could do it if there was no state funds. So I don't
that's
find
not
that
correct.
Can we ask a lawyer how New York City can do something like that?
Yeah.
I think this is going to probably get postponed, but I think in the meantime, while in the week, I think that question is one of many that need to be answered. Legislator Cale?
Yeah, so in the, thank you. So I guess I'll go to Planner Doyle since you seem to be in the hot seat. My question is, in the portion of the agreement, or the proposal, I should say, I want to get to the right, the direct housing development funding, there are
what
six...
What page are you on?
It's on page...
Got it, I got it.
Okay, 59. Oh, four, okay. Yeah. 59 of PDF, I know they never match, but... proposed funding by project type and the direct housing development, there's six entries in there, and my question is, how many of those six categories that are in there, are there actually projects in the hopper for right now that would have qualified for this? I don't expect you to have the exact number, but are you aware of, you know, any projects at all that would qualify for 1 through 6, which, you know, the owner occupied, I mean, that's the accessory dwelling, I guess, would be that, right?
And
affordable housing projects, there's the big projects, small projects, non-traditional housing, that'd be the accessory dwelling, I guess. Emergency supportive housing projects, low-income housing tax credit, rental projects. How many projects like that are we looking at right now today that would qualify for that? Because my concern is, that, and this, I'm going to fold it right in here, that we're allocating $3 million in anticipation of these projects, but yet I'm not aware of of any of them, quite honestly, other than ones that we talk about all the time, right? The RUPCO on 28 and Golden Hill and the one out in Marlboro, you know, but other than that.
So the short answer is we've had some outreach with respect to projects that are going through the approval process with respect to low-income housing tax credits. We also are aware that there are some projects that are contemplated for development. We have two projects in SOCAS that are going through their approval process that may be able to essentially move to some sort of affordability if these kinds of funds are available. But as I said before, the anticipation would be is that once these funds are available, that you would find more and more people essentially looking to outreach and to use those types of funds within their capital framework. And as more and more communities move towards essentially providing for affordability, then there's more and more opportunities and incentives for people to approach us with respect to that. Do I have a use for that now? The short answer is no. The longer answer is we would anticipate that if we issue a NOFA for this funding available, that these things would come in front of us, and there would be more and more projects that would be absolutely in front of us. The other thing I would say is that one of the things that we did here in consultation with the legislative sponsor was to make sure that at the end of this process, that essentially where applications came in, there was a body that was established to essentially make those recommendations and to vet those applications, and then the final decision rests with the legislature. So at the end of this, whether it should, could, will, shall, the decision to fund rests with the legislature itself in terms of those things coming in. We would anticipate that as we look at how the contracts are written, similar to what you did with respect to ARPA, that those contracts would essentially have those necessary assurances to make the legislature comfortable in issuing the funding. If the legislature wasn't comfortable in issuing the funding, it wouldn't have to approve it. So the leverage here is on the legislative approval, and what we can say is that these are things that we would know that that the legislature would be expecting. In particular, the level of affordability, the length of affordability, and the ability to audit that affordability. So we would include in those contracts those things that would necessarily assure the legislature that we had the ability to do that. Somebody couldn't hide their books from us, so to speak.
Oh, I had a technical question, and that's in terms of the appointments. It says that the county executive's office may not appoint current county executive staff. Can someone define county executive staff for me?
I would think it would be anyone that would report. I'm sorry, did I take your?
We have actual PLs, so it would be anyone that's the assistant deputies, the confidential chief diversity officer, and deputy county executives.
So that means a director of planning could be appointed, or
I mean, they're not considered
executive.
Please, no. Yeah. I think it's a good point to clarify.
I'm going to say I have concerns. Yeah, I'm going to say I have concerns with it just being the executive staff if legislators aren't allowed on, which I think is wise, allowing an appointee of the executive or an employee seems not wise, like, especially when both the legislature and the executive are going to be given liaisons. So between now and next week, if there is a postponement, I would like that. I'd like to hear what everyone else thinks, but I'd like to see that change to not be staff.
Yeah, I think all county employees and probably elected officials around the county as well should probably think about having not. With regards to what the planning director just said a minute ago, it's ultimately up to us. That's an argument we hear a lot through the years, but once it gets to us, for the most part, when it's a done deal and it's going to be housing, you're going to be voting no against housing. By that time, we're a yes every time. So as far as don't worry about the language being suggestive, you can still go back and say, no, we're never going to do that because something in there. If we want something to come to us in a way that we want it, we should put the language in there to mandate that it's there, because we're never going to go back and go,
if that little thing was there, I'd be a yes, but I'm a no now. Very few of us will do that, at least. With regards to overall, my last comment will be talking about $3 million a year, I think, multiple projects. By the time these larger projects come, it's not like Penrose or someone else is here because the county's going to give them a couple of bucks. These state and federal tax credits, that's the big ones. If they have a piece of property, they want to be in Ulster County, they're not going to end up, our little cherry on top is not what's going to make them find their way to Ulster County. So what we're going to end up doing on these bigger projects is just subsidizing something that was going to happen anyways for the most part. I think the focus for the county should really be ADUs and smaller projects that actually will not happen if not for our funding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a conversation with the sponsor a couple of weeks ago about the oversight committee and how the members are appointed. As it stands right now, the minority party only has one pick, and that's recommended pick. There's nothing in writing that it shall be followed by the chairperson, so that should be changed. And I think there should be a fairer equity in minority representation. So I am looking at changing maybe the appointments from the county legislature getting 4 or 5 picks and the executive staff getting 3 or 2. If we had 5 for the legislature, that would give the minority party 2 picks.
Mr. Erner?
Thank you. Yeah, about who's on this committee. In Public Works, we've been discussing establishing a transit riders advisory committee where a majority of the membership are folks who take transit. Similarly, I'd like to see this committee consist of a majority of members who have experience with the housing crisis that we're trying to address by this legislation. So I'm not sure how we decide who that is, but I think they should be folks who've suffered a severe impact to their own housing security, at least the majority of the members. And they can go and speak with whomever they need to, who has other expertise, technical and so forth, but that would be what I would prefer.
I'm just going to make a motion to postpone.
Can I ask one more question before we do that? So what are we anticipating will change between now and next week that we're postponing it today? I'm just curious what the... go ahead, Dave. Thank you.
I was going to speak on the postponement, but since you prompted, I can speak now. I was going to keep quiet if there was no postponement. We just hope it all worked out. But so there are a few suggestions that I've written down here that I think we can address. I want to run it past Dennis and the planning team just to make sure that we're not causing any issues with how the program would operate, but I see removing all staff, all county staff entirely from being applicable to serve on the board would be wise. The replacement of shall in place of should I think would be wise, but I'd like to understand if that would tie us in some way that would be onerous. Changing the minority appointments I think would be reasonable. Tipping the scale towards the legislature, I think, is also reasonable. There are a number of, and I'll commit to having a marked up copy for the next Ways and Means meeting so that you'll see that. Actually, I'll commit to having that by the end of this week so that you can review it ahead of time. There are a number of suggestions and commentary around this proposal that I would put in the category of posing a bit of a catch-22 situation. I've been working on this for a very, very long time, and during that time I have heard the fund is going to dry up, it is not going to work if we don't make it ongoing funding. I've also heard that the ongoing funding is going to be too much and it's not going to work if the ongoing funding exceeds the amount that we can spend it. I've heard that there are projects in the hopper, that we want to hear that there are projects in the hopper so that we know that it's going to be effective. I've also heard that we want to make sure that there aren't projects in the hopper that would have gotten approval anyway, and we want to make sure that it's only new projects. I've heard that communities should only participate if they are committing to change zoning, because really none of this works unless communities change zoning. I've also heard that that communities that don't change their zoning should be allowed to participate. I've heard that, I've heard that there might be a recession coming up and we're going to want to not have locked up that money, right, in case there's a recession and we have declining tax revenues. I've also heard that the money isn't locked up enough and it shouldn't be an assignment, and instead it should be a reserve fund. Obviously, these cannot all be addressed. We're going to have to make compromises. Some of these are pretty clear. Some of the language that I mentioned in the beginning we can change, but some of them we're going to have to give it our best shot. We've been dealing with this housing crisis for years, and I truly believe this is our best chance of making a dent. It's not going to happen overnight, but we've got to move forward with something. So I'm looking forward to making a lot of these changes, and I'm looking forward to your compassion and compassion towards our constituents, knowing that not every concern is going to be addressed, but I hope that we're going to move forward with something.
Just to that, I've asked a lot of questions. I don't think any of those were mine, but to think that we're going to solve or even put a dent in the housing crisis by subsidizing a couple of apartment complexes that end up screwing the school district and becoming a lottery is to me, pie in the sky. A lot of the decisions the government has made is why we're in the housing crisis. And here in Ulster County, we have a population that's flat or has decreased. And yet, there's been lots of units built, lots of houses built over those years, and there's still nowhere to live. If we don't start attacking the real problems of housing and not just subsidizing developers and giving away money, which drives taxes up even higher, then, but it does feel good to think that we're going to put a dent in the housing crisis. It's not the way it is.
On that note, I'll make a motion to postpone for a week.
Second.
Thank you. Votes in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Thank you.
337. I got a motion.
I'll move for discussion.
Second.
I was just going to make a motion to postpone for a month. The rest of the resolutions are postponed. I feel like this one is sitting out on its own. So.
Second that one. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay.
That was for a month.
It was for a month. Because everything else is postponed for a month.
Yeah. 369 as presented.
I'll move for discussion.
Second. Discussion.
I feel the same way I have every month since this has been in. My comments previously stand. I'm not going to belabor it.
I just want to follow up before Brian starts giving us all kinds of facts again. You can follow up with your facts, Brian. That's okay. But anyway, I know there was a lot of talk back and forth at these meetings about potential compromises. Has any movement been accomplished in that? With the training aspects or...
I mean, to Kevin's, I think part of Kevin's question is, don't want to speak for you, but, has anybody else come in for training with the financial staff? I mean, that's one of the things that,
I don't want to speak for Kevin either, but I'm not sure that Kevin was asking if people had come in for training. Like, I took Kevin's question more to be about last time Deputy Executive Kelly had a lot to say about, you know, I'm trying to understand what you all want, and I'm trying to, and I think the question, at least my follow-on question, is like, where are we at with all of that? There was a bunch of back and forth, not about who came in to train, but, you know, what the concerns from the other side of the house. In fact, he's gone as well, but Deputy Majority Leader Ushetel last week sort of made the point that not hearing a lot of several legislators expressed concern, and Deputy Executive Contreras expressed a specific kind of concern, but there was the kind of, well, what actually is the problem with certain people having the same accessibility as our financial analysts? And where we left it, as I recall, last meeting was, well, now I'm just finding out that that's what you mean, that it's what the financial analysts, and then there was a sort of very heated discussion that we left it on that heated discussion. So I don't know, independent of whether any of us trained on the system, where did we go with the heated discussion?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's what you were more about.
More or less. I mean, it seemed like we're kind of close to taking a vote on it with, you know, a few, you know, maybe given a time limit, you know, we could pass the law in maybe 3 months. It won't take effect for 3 months, and make sure we iron out all the bugs in it, possibly the, you know, the training aspect and what legislators want to take part in it. You know, and I know you had some concerns, Chair, and, you know, but it seemed like, yeah, it seemed like you were, you know, at least quasi for this.
Yeah.
Thanks. I mean, you know, so that since I wasn't speaking to Kevin's point, I'll speak to that point about who's coming to take a look at it and who hasn't. I mean, you know, are we passing a policy that gives all of us access to something that only two of us are going to use? That's one of my points, is that, you know, if people aren't interested in coming in, and I know Legislator Criswell did, right? You came in and sat with the staff. You know, but you know, it's my question is, are we doing this big thing for a couple of legislators?
So similar comment. I think that the compromise area is to have people trained in a certain level to have some confidence that they'll be getting accurate, intelligent data from the system. And having people come and work with the analyst is a good way to get a sense of how much that would be. You know, does it have to be to a level of a certification to use the system? Probably not, although that'd be where I would prefer to go, because if you're certified, then you'll get, instead of getting garbage out, you'll get useful information out. So I think that if there's, you know, a way to gather some information about what that certification, or if it's something less than certification, what we would, you know, want people to do. I just think that doing this, where if the way that you phrased the question was to get the information that our analysts have access to, the way that they have access to it is because they're trained to be able to get that information out. So you don't just give access and then magically people get information out. You give access and people start pressing on keys and get stuff out. And the difference between stuff and information is a big difference. So, yeah.
Well, first of all, the resolution was amended to resolve that training is required. I mean, that's in there. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, to Minority Leader Ronk's point, if only a couple legislators want to use it, I'm not inclined to say no to them. I mean, I feel like I've yet to see, there's an articulated concern about information coming to legislators that they don't know how to use. Like, that happens kind of on the regular anyway, potentially. So if a legislator wants to be able to look, I would expect that if a legislator has access, has been trained, it's read-only access. There was some back and forth about what that means, which that needs to be clarified. But, and it's only on the county-issued devices, which that's a security issue that, again, Juan confirmed, but it's good. But if a legislator has information, it just may elucidate a question that then they have for our financial analyst to say, hey, I saw this, can you give me some more information about that? Or maybe they take the information and it informs some of their own thinking. I mean, I have yet to really wrap my brain around the nightmare circumstance of this, because we are all elected officials, and I no one's articulated what the big problem is to me yet. Again, especially with training.
Deputy Fair Kelly?
So we have been looking at, New World has a transparency portal. We're seeing if that's something that's useful, where we'd be able to open up access both to public and elected officials. The other part is just, again, to the point of access is granted, access is defined based on the role the individual performs in an organization. And that goes from everything from your account clerk, accountant, where you sit on the chain of approvals. I only have certain accesses, so it's based on the function you perform. So I guess it'd be, you guys are not, with all due respect, financial analysts. You're elected officials, you're appropriators and policymakers, so defining a ledge view or some type of specific role within the system that respects your role in this kind of chain is how you would approach it. So there was something that was created years ago that I have the information services team researching, which is actually called ledge view. And I'm just trying to figure out how it was created, was it used, is it used, and if that's fitting with what you guys need or desire. I guess what hasn't been effectively communicated is within our system of setting up controls and defining roles and responsibilities and our literally most critical financial system, as we do for every individual that touches it, what is the role? Is it to run reports? You're not, like you said, read-only view to everything. Like, we don't grant that to anyone. That's not how the system works. So what is the role? Is it to, I think it's probably run reports on expenditures, be more current if you want to run, if learn those functions, I guess. But I guess it's defining that part of it would help us continue the research. So that's all.
Mr. Kale?
Thank you. So first of all, I think if any age, ledge view is probably going to be a blank screen anyway, if we get there. But back to what you were discussing, because that's really what I wanted to discuss. So when each query in a database would mean, you know, depending on what you're setting up as a query, as Deputy Executive Kelly was just saying, you know, you may need access to multiple screens, right, to get the results you're looking for, right? So how would you do that ahead of time? How would you grant access to somebody who says, I want to know about this particular project that has tentacles in multiple areas of the database? How would you grant that access on every single, you know, opportunity to go and look at the database? See, so, you know, as somebody who works on databases, you know, Chris is exactly right. You know, not everybody has access to everything. And I've said this over and over again, you know, establishing the parameters for users is really determined by what you're doing in your job. And it's not on a as-is, as-needed, as-used basis. It's on the description of your job and what the function of your job is. So what do you have to do at the end of the day? What do you have to produce? What report do you have to produce? What bill do you have to pay? You know, do you have to get invoices? Do you have to review job applications, right? So all of those things are part of a database, and the access is granted to individuals as they need it, not on you know, as a job description, not on it as is or as used basis, right? And to me, that level of complexity is really where I get hung up, right? Because I know that, you know, what our intention here, I fully understand it, right? And I don't disagree with it. We want information, right? And guess what? We have two very able clerks who can help us with that. And I just don't see how we can go forward with this, knowing what I know about how complex these databases are and the ability to actually get the data you're looking for without having to wait a week to get the security clearance that you need or to grant it access to this screen or access to this part of the data. It's just, it's just a really super highly complex issue, you know? And there's really good reasons why people don't have access to everything, right? Is that wrong?
Thanks. You know, with respect to Chairwoman Bartels' point about training, I don't see anything that requires that legislators take training. It requires that training be offered. And that's one problem that I have is that, you know, again, if I were to ever support this resolution, which I'm not sure I see a path to that, it would be that legislators, before gaining their access, are required to take the training on New World, because I feel like opening up untrained individuals to this kind of a program is the biggest problem that we have here. The other thing is, I think to Legislator Cahill's point, you know, when you have, like, if they were to open up access to legislators for everything, we would be getting into protected information when you delve down into the individual journal entries and the individual invoices, because some of the invoices are going to have protected information on it. You know, DSS client information, health department patient information. I've been told otherwise by our people, so...
So my frustration is something I've expressed before, that we're trying to make a decision on a tool that, to the best of my knowledge, I'm the only legislator who has actually sat and worked with the staff to look at this tool. So we're all talking about this tool over and over again, but nobody's actually sat with it and looked at it to see what it can do. So I really highly suggest that we spend time in a meeting and we have somebody with a laptop put it up on the screen, and we can see it, and we can actually understand it and see the complexity or see the simplicity of it. But we're talking about this thing like we know what it is, and nobody really knows what it is, you know, so let's get it up there before we actually make this decision.
You know, we oversee a $400 million budget and set policy for the entire county. A lot of times, we're the only people in the room at any point that have real private sector experience and aren't living off the tax dollar. Pretty sure John, Tracy, Kevin would get pretty good on New World and whatnot if given a chance. I'm pretty sure Laura Petit, another thing, we're part-time legislators. We do a lot of our work at night. Guess when the budget analysts are off at night? For Laura to be able to go on as the head, as the chair of DPW and look up where the Elizabeth Street contract is at, how much has been at 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night, you're telling me that wouldn't be valuable for us? It's just kind of crazy to hear us all undermine ourselves and say, we're not going to be able to handle this, guys. And then the exec people come and say, you won't be able to handle this. Here we are on the sixth floor. That guy right there is one of the most accomplished people in the county. He runs a business. He's highly successful. He deals with regulations, employees, insurances. I'm pretty sure he'd be capable to get a feel for this financial system, and I'm pretty sure it'd be valuable for the legislators that want to use it. Maybe. And like I said, I could care less whether this offends anybody or not. It'll happen next year. If we don't get it done this year, I've already talked. I got 12 votes next year. I've talked to many people running. This is a done deal next year. We can wait a couple of months. That's fine. Let's wait. Let's not waste any more time on it.
I'm good with putting it up on the screen if that's what we want to do. What I'd like to do between now and next week is, can someone, and this is probably a question for Natalie, define for me what access you and Amber have, very specifically. Because we're talking about access to protected information, which I'm pretty sure that Natalie and Amber don't accidentally run across protected, so, you know, Social Services information, but maybe they do, and if so, I'd want to know that. And we're talking about, I think we're really specific that that's the kind of access we're talking about, but then we zoom out and we talk about everything, access to everything, read-only everything, and that's not, no one's saying that. So I'd like to begin pretty quickly by understanding exactly and very specifically what access our financial analysts have.
So I'd like to understand what the training would be, and I think it would need to be required to make me, you know, at all comfortable, but I'm not sure that would get me there either. I've designed databases. I've done a lot of work in databases. I've also done work in financial systems. So it's based on that that I think I understand largely how this system works and why I don't want to spend a lot of time training to go in to do it, even though I think I could get very good at it very quickly. I could also make mistakes because it's a very specialized system, and it's my familiarity, and it's what I hear from Legislator Cahill, familiarity with databases and how easy it is to get a report and you look at it and you go, oh, that can't be right. I must have done something wrong. And so you go back in. You can get dates wrong. So my nightmare scenario, and maybe it needs to be addressed by what happens after somebody uses the system, but my nightmare scenario is somebody goes in and goes, oh, we overspent by $46 million on this phase of this project, and goes to the press with that, then all of us will be spending months dealing with something that our financial analyst would have gone, oh, but you had a decimal point there, or you had, you know, last year's information. Now, it can happen with your financial analyst, as we've seen. It can happen with people who are paid professionals. But the likelihood of it happening with somebody who's going in there to just kind of dig around goes up and up and up the more digging there is, because the system is intricate, and it will give you out stuff even if you have kind of, not always, but often will give you stuff even if you have requests that wouldn't make sense in a real world scenario. So very clear training, and we should consider, I'm sorry to say, we should consider getting rid of our financial analysts, because clearly we can just have, you know, legislators pick this up in a couple of weeks and do it ourselves. That's the situation that we were in previously, and we didn't get good information. So that's not a serious suggestion, but it is a suggestion to point to how we set up a very intelligent system to make sure we got accurate information on which to base our decisions. And I don't want to go back to a situation where I'm getting information that I trust much less.
Mr. Chris,
I'm going to pass. Thank you.
Well, I mean, I'm glad that's not a serious suggestion, because obviously our financial analysts provide us, you know, amazing, an amazing resource, and not all of us equally would want to use the system. But I do think that there are some people, and if I were staying, I would probably be one of them, who wanted to use the system and would use the system to get information of allowable to see, to provide me backup in the same way that I ask Natalie or Amber for very specific asks. I think that's a good suggestion to require training. I think that's a basic. I don't know that training was required for Natalie or Amber, but I'm sure they used it. I mean, I'm sure they needed it. May I ask, were you trained?
Lisa Cotton came and sat with me for like a little bit,
okay.
An hour.
Okay, so our financial analyst had an hour of training. Not to say that they don't have financial background, but had an hour of training. I think we should be required to have training. I think both things need to exist. We need our financial analysts, and undoubtedly there are going to be legislators who never want to look at it. But to the point that Legislator Nolan made about a legislator who would go and get bad information and go to the press, that's like the person who cried wolf. That's going to happen one time, and that person's going to be smacked down by either our analyst or the executive staff saying that's totally inaccurate, and that's going to be a giant embarrassment. You can't keep just like pulling things out of the air and throwing them out there. Like, I think we're creating problems that aren't yet here. Again, I'd like to see the requirement. I think that's a really good suggestion. There should be a requirement for training, and that needs to be talked about between now and next week, and there should probably be very specific parameters around what the access is related to what our financial analysts have.
You already passed.
I'm kidding. I think I told you, so I went directly to the makers of this tool and asked them about training, and they said there is not just a general training for this system. It's very specific depending on what the component is that you have, and so we'd have to actually figure out like what training exactly.
They would train us, because if they were trained by Lisa Cutton, they would sit with us.
Right. I mean, that's what I'm just saying. We'd have to figure out really specifically what that training is and how that would work. So, yeah. Sorry. Teacher.
Do they offer support?
There's support videos. There's like help videos that you can pull off on the system itself, but they don't actually have like training support. They don't have training
support. Most of the times, this enterprise level software is like a shell that is customized for the end user.
Exactly.
So it's, you know, they'll give you a high level training, and then you use your internal programmers to set it up and do what you need to do.
Right.
For the
market.
Is it wrong?
Make a motion to be postponed for a week.
Second. Question? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So carried. 370 as presented.
I'm a no on that postponement.
Sorry?
No on the postponement.
No.
I'll move it for discussion.
Second.
Second.
Discussion. Zero.
I would support this if, yeah, because the concern that I've heard from Legislator Petit and others is that, you know, you have to have a BidNet account to see the documents online. I would support this if we changed it to read that when the county executive puts a contract on BidNet, they send it to the clerk of the legislature for distribution to the legislature.
Could I just ask a point of clarification? This says draft, so this would be.
I understand. I'm. Okay. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So I don't support the draft before it's done, but when it's put on BidNet, I think that it should be sent to the legislature. That way, we see all the RFPs that are going out.
I think that's fair.
And to me, that solves the problem of something being in draft form and having it before it goes out, and problems that provides for, you know, complying with proper bidding processes.
We'd be good with that.
My one concern is whether or not this gets out of intent. Like what we saw happen multiple times is that, and we're talking about legislative proposals on legislative policies where there's deep legislative discussion about what's expected, and then what ends up going out doesn't reflect that at all. And then it's too late. Then we have a bid that's gone out and it's not reflective of the legislative intent. So how do we get around, again, we're not talking about, you know, full open public, but it's like if Vice Chair Criswell has an initiative, which this sort of happened, you know, has an initiative and there's very specific intent behind the initiative and that's discussed in committee and then an RFP goes out for a bid and it doesn't reflect that. It's after the fact. Like, yes, you'd see it, and then Vice Chair Criswell would say, oh, we have to now change all of that. So, again, I don't think it needs to be widely, but I think there is some level of respect that the drafting of a document related to a legislative proposal where you'd want to engage the sponsor at the least in terms of making sure the intent is captured.
Say more.
Yeah, first of all, you have some time, at least for us, with Ken's suggestion, at least to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, we don't have to award the bid. We could go back and rebid if there was immediate discussion around it. Somebody flagged it and said, pull it, please. You know, at least they'd give us some time. But perhaps anyone listed as a sponsor as a legislator as well, you know, would be able to see the draft.
Prime sponsor. Sorry for interrupting.
Yeah. But that's another, that's something else we could add on. I like what Ken's doing, but it doesn't solve the issues that we've been having and where we've been kind of, we've talked about it. We think we have a feel for what's going to go into the RFP. Or the RFQ, and then we find out later that's not what ended up happening, and we were taking the word of who, you know, purchasing and their representatives. So it doesn't solve any problem, but I like it, and I would just like, if we do go that route partially, that it's immediate, the moment it's drafted, it's sent to Ledge Clerk to be disseminated, so at least we do have a head start to jump on it, look at it, and make sure that we're okay, and it's be fresh in our mind at that point. We would have just left committee and talked about it, perhaps.
I could actually take it one better, I think, Joe. Not, I agree with you 100%. I mean, there's several things I think that we could do, especially with the legislative initiatives. You know, as the legislature, if we wanted to, we could take ownership of those and run with them ourselves. We can direct that the purchasing director works with the legislature, or, you know, we could use our oversight authority to say that we want the legislature to be involved in either the drafting, reviewing, or whatnot of those RFPs. But also, you know, we have our oversight ability, like you said, to, you know, not adopt, you know, or not award the bids or the proposal when it comes to us, if the RFP didn't include our stuff. But by getting the RFP ahead of time, the legislature could, if the RFP is not drafted the way we want it to, the legislature has time to go to the executive's office and say, if you don't add an addendum with this information, we're not going to approve it when it comes to the legislature. So having the access to them even when they're up on BidNet gives us that time to fight for the addendum that we would want, I think.
Yeah, my experience has been that working with the executive's team on contracts that would go out, that has been the cooperative, interactive way of doing things. Now, it doesn't happen necessarily unless the legislator that are bringing forth the legislation are in there asking for that and getting that. So if the policy is to try to mandate a good practice, then I'm sympathetic to it. But I think I've experienced very good practice on that. The idea of having immediate access when it gets posted is a very good idea, because it can be pulled down if no bids have been received. And that would be a way to get the oversight in without having the situation that generated this resolution, I believe, in which there was somebody completely unrelated to the project who, as a legislator, just said, give me access. And that can be disruptive if there is a team that is a legislative executive team working together towards an end point with all of the committee input, and then somebody comes in and says, oh, I see this now. We have a lot of process to make sure that these discussions happen, and I think maybe if we need to have more interaction around these bids, I think it should be with a designated person for each bid. Otherwise, we have like multiple people coming and trying to get access to the draft bid is, I think, unwieldy.
Thank you. And I would have liked to have been more involved in writing resolutions and putting in programs and asking in advance if we could have some input, and not even knowing that the RFPs had gone out until it was beyond the deadline and they'd already received proposals. But with that, I would be agreeable to, at least getting the request for proposals as soon as they get posted. Because then we do have an opportunity to put an addendum if there's something that's really striking. And also, the last whereas on the first page does have, Chair Bartels, from time to time a legislator may request to review a draft document on a legislative program or incentive they have sponsored or contributed to.
What?
Well, first of all, it's a whereas, so it's not binding. I mean, okay. It's background. Did someone else want to?
Yeah,
did you have someone before?
Debbie
me?
Did. Yeah.
Okay, so
yeah.
Then I'll do the.
I would just offer up. There's probably another opportunity if you guys pass something like Legislator Criswell with the Arts Master Plan. There's a clear intent with what you had. I think sometimes intent could be lost where we have a robust discussion around a program in a committee that doesn't always necessarily translate well into an RFP. If it's not specifically laid out in the whereases or the resolve to say this is exactly what I want to see in there, that could be lost. So I'm thinking of an intermediary step before the drafting is an implementation memo from the sponsor to the director of purchasing, so they have that clear language and it's in writing and there's no ambiguity to it. And then it's not in the middle of the process. And then you get it bookended, you get in the front, and then we'll send it out upon posting.
Chair Criswell.
And to that point, I just had a really good experience with purchasing on this project where I went and sat with them and talked to them about this project, here's what I'm looking for, and gave them an example of another RFP that I used for a city project, and they used that as a basis, and it was a very collaborative process, and it actually was very expedited. We got it done really quickly, got the RFPs out there, and got responses, and I feel like it's exactly what I want to be doing with things that I'm bringing to the table, is to see it through to its to where it's going out to the world. So I'm happy to make that happen.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, we can be really, really specific in the resolution. We're looking for putting an addendum to the resolution, with what we want to see in the RFP. If it's a legislative initiative that's going to result in an RFP, we can be real specific in the resolution what we want to see there. And that's basically what Deputy Exec Kelly was just saying, right? You know, we should be doing that. If we have a resolution that has really specific criteria, we should put it in there, and that will, you know, pretty much force the purchasing department to do what we're trying to do, right?
Yep.
Well, I was just going to say that, I mean, it seems like the issue at hand that we're trying to correct is the fact that a lot of times we don't see the RFP until there's a resolution to accept it or go to contract. So if you were to give the legislators a copy of the RFP when it is posted, that gives you time to look at it, review it. I mean, almost every RFP that goes out, there's amendments to. And if it's really not what you want, then we don't have to accept the RFPs or you have plenty of time.
I mean, I agree with Minority Leader's suggestion in terms of the media access after posted. I think that's good. For me, and Legislator Petit's suggestion to that, whereas for me, the like where this resonates has to do with legislative resolutions, legislative policy, where legislative intent's not being followed. I do feel like the language, particularly in the last resolve, is broad. It starts to step on operations, having two legislators on every RFP committee, which seems to be what this is saying. Every non-commodity RFP is over the top. A lot is. I mean, it's really, as someone who's had to put legislators on it, I mean, it's hard to get legislators to sit on these things. And RFPs go out, multiple RFPs go out every month. They're coming back every month. So you'd have legislators sitting on basically on everything. And I think that's way in the realm of operations. But I do have to say, to be fair, like the executive side of the house has been very collaborative, but there was definitely pushback when there was in a month a flurry of legislative resolutions that were requesting legislative seats of like, why are we seeing all these legislative seats on the RFP selection committee? And they were legislative initiatives. So it's a balance. Again, I think this resolution seems to be broader and stepping on operations, but I do want to ensure that we're thinking about. And I also like the implementation language memo that you're suggesting. I think it's something that we should think about on this side of the house about how to facilitate that in an expedited way as resolutions are going out and we have an expectation that they're going to pass, that we're putting things in writing that are going to help purchasing. So I like the conversation that this is engendering. Like, I think that's there's a lot of good here, but again, I don't want to. This, some of it's unmanageable and probably aberration.
Okay. That's fair money.
Yeah, why don't we amend? First of all, I would say that I'm more concerned as a legislator about non-legislative starting resolutions and contracts. That's where I really want to know that these RFPs are written for a lot of different reasons and in correct ways. But And that's where I worry about the discussions we have when we're asked to vote on something, we vote on it, and then we find out later there may have been things in the RFP that we weren't happy with, and maybe it wasn't as broad as we thought it was going to be and have as many people able to bid. So it's, for me, it's not just about, but I think it goes without saying, if we're putting something up, we should be very involved, and I think the executive branch of government on those, I think if we, like Kathy says, if we go and follow, like Pete has found, when he goes and follows up on an initiative of his own, he ends up getting cooperation. That's when we're presented with something that I want to go and follow and make sure we don't have something in mind to begin with. But for this, I'd be willing, if the floor is willing, to take out the language about legislators being involved in the bid awarding. I thought it was struck
very,
as well,
very
but if it's not, let's strike it. If it's not, and I think going into the future,
yeah,
a conversation that would make sense is having the minority or the majority leader at any time on any RFP being able to request that one of the five members is an appointee of theirs to go and be part of the bid awarding. I think that's an appropriate amount of oversight, and it'd be something that we could handle doing.
Can you repeat that? I'm sorry.
It's a discussion for another day because we're omitting anything that's even involving this, and then I think we go back to what Ken suggested and just attack it this way to begin with and get these RFPs immediately within 12 or 24 hours, whatever we put in there.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought a conversation to be started was on any single RFP would be that the minority or the majority leader, if given enough time ahead of time, can request that an appointee of theirs in from their caucus would be one of the five members. So we could have up to two members of that, I think it's a five-member team, that awards bids at any time to go be involved with the awarding of anything that the legislature wanted involvement in. But that is
an unofficial achievement.
That's for another day. We just get down to basically we'd be passing something today that Ken suggested before that everyone seems to be in agreement with.
Can we get that?
Once we take out the two last results.
Can we do this by next week?
Yeah.
Can you give us a marked up version?
Yeah.
Okay.
If you want to email me some thoughts, and I can email you some thoughts,
it's
and we
more
come
or less
up with
just
yeah.
What I said, just make sure the language is specific enough where we have within 24 hours.
I wouldn't even say it within 24 hours. I wouldn't give that leeway. I would say immediately upon posting on BidNet. It's not.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, that's you know, immediately upon you know, issuing or whatever whatever language you guys are comfortable with, and gets us what we want.
Have to mark up
but I definitely think it's a next week thing. I don't think it's a week.
That's fine.
I don't think we should be back at the napkin yet tonight.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I hope that at least for next session we think a little bit more about kind of like an educational process, a training process, so that new legislators specifically understand the process of an RFP and understand the complexity of the contracts. Our contracts are extremely complex and they have things in them that I think it would be really great to hear from some of the departments, you know, for new legislators to understand that there's all these insurance requirements, that there's, you know, X requirement, this type of thing. And so I think that will actually head off some of the problems because we'll have better training going into it, and then when we see things come back, we'll kind of know what the, you know, how the sausage is made on that side of the table. So,
I make a motion to postpone for a week. Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah. Second.
I'm the postponer today.
Aye. So carry. 372. Your motion?
I'll move it for discussion.
Second. Discussion.
100% against it. I've been against the transfer tax ever since I've been a legislator. Homeowners pay a mortgage tax when they buy a house, and now these people who have owned their home, for a lot of them, it's their number one retirement investment, and now we're going to tax them on the way out too. It's easy to tax these people because they're not going to be voters here anymore, probably. But I'm 100% against the transfer tax. It's just a way to tax people on their way out into their retirement.
Say Roberts. I thought you said wrong.
No. I just spoke.
In our efforts to fund affordable housing, it appears that we're going to make housing less affordable. So I'm going to be a no too on that.
Perfect.
I guess following on that, you know, I raised the last time we had this discussion, we talked about having a threshold on where this transfer tax would take place so that for home sales below a certain number that the transfer tax wouldn't be, and it's sort of to the point that Legislator Roberts just raised, so that those homes that might fall into affordability aren't made less affordable through the transfer tax. So that's the first thing I'd like to raise and have discussed. I know it was raised last month, but and the other thing is, can someone run the financial impact both with no based on numbers from last year or the year before, so that because I don't even
know what's going to be elevated. You're going to want to take an average or something.
Yes, whatever. But I'm just saying,
can someone run
the numbers for the past 5 years?
What are
maybe?
These 5,000 pages attached in the backup? What is that?
What are you saying?
There's a gigantic attachment, all the transfers.
Does it aggregate all the numbers?
I don't know. I'm still trying to get through it. I can't get through it.
The controller did do a report.
She did.
She did.
Yeah,
Alicia, do you have that?
Our transfer tax report from last year.
Yeah.
I'm looking for it right now. I mean, we looked at a few different things. I think one of the things we looked at was also the holding period.
Okay.
So properties that hadn't been held for a long time, but also, you know, I think we were looking to target flippers. Actually, I'm trying to find our report now.
When you find it, can you resend it just so it bumps back up?
Yeah.
That would be great. I would be okay postpone. I mean, it sounds like if it goes right now, it's going down.
I'm gonna be a no on the postponement. I just want to vote it down.
Okay, I'm okay.
If the creator of the world, whoever you believe that is, came down and said this is a good thing, I'd still vote no.
So you're not moving, but I would like this information. I mean, I'd like a postponement.
There is a table at the end that does have the projected numbers. I'm trying to see if I can determine what year that's from. Oh, 2020. And had potential for Ulster County. 2019 and 2020 would be, I'm guessing it ranges like from 2 to 6 million.
Okay, 2 to 6 million.
Yeah, I mean, depends.
And that's it. All the kind of
it depends. It depends on how much you charge.
Okay, I'm gonna wait to see what the comptroller sends us, but what's the will of the committee? I mean,
what's the resolution?
Do we
want to
move it for TBD?
Oh, okay.
Do we want that's what I'm saying. It should say, it should have a number here.
So it's got a half a dollar, $5 per thousand.
This is 50 cents, half a dollar per $500.
So that would be potential in 2019 was $1,069,000, and in 2020 was $1,232,000.
All right, so I got postponed in a month.
If there was a threshold, so maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I would want to start the conversation with the threshold. I think that's, I'm okay with a month, but.
Can I just make the comment? Or are we already on the postponement?
No, go ahead.
I was going to say on the threshold, I mean, you know, where do you set the threshold? I mean, somebody who bought their house 30 years ago for $80,000 probably has a $300,000, I mean, probably has a $400,000 house now, but real world terms, it's probably a $300,000 house. And now, if we set the threshold at $250,000, that person's, you know, is the threshold going to be the value of the house or over the threshold amount? Because I don't think
amount.
That's what this resolution contemplates at all.
I'm talking about over the threshold amount, and I think we have an example of that in one of our other taxes. Community benefit taxes, all contemplate a threshold and start the taxation over the threshold.
I'll leave it at that. I already spoke on that.
I feel pretty strongly about the threshold, but.
That's fair enough.
Thank you. I appreciate where those opposed are coming from, and that philosophical point, I can accept that. For those who might consider adopting this, I'm happy to hear what threshold you would recommend. And I just want to point out that right now we're talking about 0.1% is the tax. So if you sell your home for $100,000, it's $100. Sell your home for $500,000, it's $500. That's the tax. That said, I haven't done much more work on this in the past month, so if it's the committee's will to postpone, I certainly would appreciate that. But if you're going to take a vote and it goes down in defeat, at least we've had the discussion.
Sorry, Mark?
I think there's so many taxes in New York. There's so many of these ways we come up with for nickel and dime our citizens, and this is just, to me, another example of that. It's only $500, but there's 400 other things we're doing, and it all adds up. And we've just, our state in particular, has gone down a road of figuring out ways to nickel and dime our citizens, and especially just not being a necessary time of need when you look at fund balance and everything else. This is a move to consider when we're desperate, when it really hits the fan in a couple of years, which I think a lot of us think is coming. But right now, it just feels like one more thing, just a typical New York nickel and diming of our citizens. And a lot of people's retirements are literally their home. So we're nickel and diming people's retirement.
Chairman Dell?
I was going to ask him to postpone it for a month.
Second.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Both?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, thank you. 381, can I have a motion?
Move that. Bill.
Second.
Second.
Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Carried. 382.
I'll move 382 for discussion.
I'll second it.
Discussion. We need some more information on this, so I have to ask for a week postponement. Yeah, I have for a week postponement.
I'll make that motion.
Second. Discussion. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. So carried.
Did
you
get
381? 382. 381
passed,
right? Yes. 387. Can I have a motion? Second?
Second.
Second discussion?
I guess I'm just wondering if anything's changed since the last time we spoke about this. Again, we're in the budget cycle, so I feel like this should be a part of the discussion. In budget.
So, I did have some discussion. I did have some discussion, and I thought that the one thing that seems clearer to me is this question about what the people that were being hired are there for. And so my understanding is that the person who would be hired to do this is hired as the investigator. And 99% of the time, roughly, maybe even higher than that, that's what they would be doing. But if 1% of the time there's a need for a trained professional, which could happen, then these particular people happen to be trained professionals, in fact, very highly trained professionals. So it reminded me of like anesthesiology, where anesthesiologists do almost nothing except monitor for 99% of the time. But then when you need them, you want somebody who knows all the stuff that an anesthesiologist knows of how to do a full-fledged resuscitation. At the same time, you don't want to have your anesthesiologist, you know, or somebody that's that kind of person, and this kind of go back to the real world example, you don't want to have a uniformed or a person who's hired to be that 1% and who can't do the 99% of the work. If you think you're going to have 99% of the time, you're going to need that investigative quality. So I think I think it's hard to get a mental image of the fact that there's a person who would be doing a job almost completely along the lines of the investigative realm, but covering every possibility that could happen there, you want somebody with that other credential. And that's how you have somebody saying, no, I'm not being hired to be a security guard, because they're not in their own mind. They're being hired to be an investigator. But they could also be said to be able to function as a security guard if that emergency situation should arise.
Thank you, there's no. So I'm going to address that. So the answer to Chairperson Tell's question, no new information then has been presented. The same thing you just said is the same thing that's been said for the past month.
Almost.
Almost. I mean, there's nothing new has come out of that. The discussion, at least from several of us, is the argument that if you need security, we'll hire security. If we need an investigator, that's when the budget process is. Saying that they can do it, well, of course. Can they do it? Sure. But I don't think, not speaking for anybody else, but speaking for myself, I'm not interested in hiring somebody to do a potential job that they maybe in their downtime could possibly do. I just have no interest in doing that. If they want an investigator, then that's when they should have been. I asked specifically last month for this question to be answered. What changed between October and November of last year during the budget time and February of this year? So far, no answer has been produced.
So, with respect, did we know at that time that the geography, topography, architecture of the space that this was going to be in?
Yes.
And we have had ample time to go through all of the alternatives? I don't think so. I'm seeing heads nod yes that we have that.
With all due respect, and if I could just jump in here, because I was a big part of this and shouted down proverbially proverbially, in that Ways and Means Committee meeting, because I talked about hiring security guards from the sheriff's, armed security from the sheriff's office back then to handle this space, and I was told by the chief assistant district attorney that that was not going to work for them, and that the investigators extra that we gave them in the budget over my objection were going to handle the security at the building in the currently situated space, because it came up late in the budget process and it was an amendment. And so yes, we had that, we had a thorough discussion on that, and then this is at least the second time that we've gone to try to make a part-time investigator in a different line. You know, this is the second different line we've tried to make permanent, and one of the arguments that keeps being brought up is security. And you know, if I could just continue on that point, you know, I think if the district attorney had come and said, you know, traffic accidents and fatalities are up this much, this investigator does accident reconstruction, we need more accident reconstruction in our office because BCI is backed up and the sheriff's department is backed up and we need to be able to do the accident reconstruction, I'd be willing to bet you that many legislators around this table, myself included, would say, you know what, you're absolutely right to keep the residents of Ulster County safe on the roads and ensure that you've got the investigatory you know, tools that you need. Absolutely, we'll make it full time. But again, when this was brought to us, it's, well, we need more help with security.
I will say again, that is the exact question. He just paraphrased it. What changed between October, November of last year and February of this year? There has been no data provided. There's been no information that shows that the accidents are up, that anything else is up. It is simply just the same old request coming to us with no data to show that there's a need that's really there.
If I could piggyback on that, I believe that accidents and fatalities are up. I believe that to be the case, but that's not the argument that's brought to us. That's not, and that's why I think that this needs to happen in the budget process, because we need to have more time to discuss the needs and overall needs of the office, because, you know, this has been a complaint of mine, and I've been lonely out on the branch on this one. There's been an awful lot of mid-year, mid-budget increases in this district attorney's office that I've never seen before. I've seen things given to this district attorney that would have never in a quadrillion years been given to Holly Carnwright when he was district attorney, when he would come and ask for it in the budget process. So again, that's part of where I keep coming back to is, like Legislator Guevara said, you know, we need to see more of a plan, and it needs to be with new information. It can't just be the same argument, which has been security.
Yeah, thank you. I agree with you about some of the no's to Holly Conright, maybe all of them. And I thought then that we should be providing more resources to that office. And I agree with that point. What I'm hearing is that, again, that what the district attorney's office says they need for security, I'm hearing legislators saying that they have better ideas, that, you know, that they want it done with a security person and not an investigator and so forth. I just don't understand that. This is a professional group, and I think that if they say they need X and Y for security, especially in the new setting that they're in, I'm inclined to give it. So that's part of my point. I'm also hearing that the general claims that think that the workload is up and it's up in all the places that Minority Leader Ronk is identifying has been made, but I'm hearing that there's no data or that not sufficient information has been provided on that point. So if that is a legitimate, you know, if there is this, then we would look at it, then I think that that is a request that should be made. I'm just find it very almost obvious that it is all up, and I also think that a tremendous dislocation, literally, that this group has been forced to do on short notice gives me a real, I think, moral imperative to try to help them out and make it good. And I just don't know of any other group that's been asked to do what they did. And then come and say, oh, but you know, we'll help you. We'll, you know, what do you need? And the one thing that he says he needs, that the department needs, that what they can't, we can't give. So if they were asking for this same amount of investment for changes in the architecture of the building, I get the sense this group would say yes. And it, so it doesn't make sense to me, because we can't do the changes in the architecture of the building that would accomplish what is being proposed to be done with staff. And just seems to me like if that's the only way we can do it, and if the legislature wants to propose this other solution that seems to be mythically out there of, you know, put the security guard standing there all day and that'll make things
What's
better.
What's mythical about that?
What is mythical is that it does not allow the function of the office. I think that we've heard multiple times that if you have somebody standing there who's not part of the process, that it inhibits the function. It in, you know, there's needs to have separate entrances and a whole system of how people get in.
I have to point of order. I think it's real. It makes me very uncomfortable to have extended security conversations in the open. I'm sorry. It's just really, we can have a general conversation, but when we start to get into very specifics, if we want to go into executive session, we'll go into executive session. I'd make
that
motion.
Allowable reason?
We'll what? Take, and I'll just stop there. I think
yes,
the point is
security of individuals. Yes. Yeah, this makes me. I mean, this is a personal, but it just makes me very uncomfortable.
I mean, if we want to fight it out some more, we can, but I don't think it's necessary.
I'm
ready to call the question. I don't know. Can I ask a question first?
Sure.
So I'm not sure if this is strictly personnel, but you were, Chris, you were tracking the benefits,
mm-hmm.
and is that something that we can talk about outside of executive session?
I don't think so. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you want to go into executive session?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to be careful too. I just want to point out that we're speaking as if the person isn't working full-time right now. The person is working full-time. So I think it is important just to note that we currently have a DA investigator who's working full-time in this position. This is proposing to make it permanent, which I suspect is also in the budget request, which is why, again, just removing all emotion from this, I feel like this is a budget information.
He just raised the hand just now,
okay.
So we're going to wrong
person. I was going to call the question, so if the DA would like to be heard, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, quick.
Yeah, just briefly, I just wanted the committee to know that within the last couple of weeks, I received notice from DCJS that our office is going to be allotted for aid to prosecution an additional $500,000, which is retroactive to April of this year. I don't have all the details of that. Just wanted to let you know that the governor's recognized that there's stress throughout the state in DA's offices retaining and recruiting new employees is an issue. So we are getting money from the governor to cover the expenses that we're asking for.
With respect to what the DA just said, without knowing the parameters of the funding, I would think that we could use some of that money to offset the county dollars that we've put into funding for discovery reform and bail reform that we've already given his office. So
we also got $500,000 for discovery from.
Yep.
Which more than covers what we received.
Yep. So with that, I'll call the question on this resolution.
All those in favor? Opposed? All right. Motion defeated. 432. Got a motion?
I'll move for discussion.
Second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Carried. 434. Can I have a motion?
I'll move it.
Second?
Second.
Discussion? You good?
Good.
Yes,
thank you.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. So carried. 436. Can I have a motion?
I'll move it.
Second?
Second.
Motion? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Carried. 437.
I'll move it.
Second?
Aye.
Discussion? All those in favor?
Legislator Kayla, did you have a comment on it?
I was supposed to
ask. Oh, okay.
These are the ARPA funds?
Yeah.
Yeah.
there's going to be no discussion. We're just going to approve all these funds to be given out.
Do you want me to explain it quickly?
Just to move out of Ways and Means.
No one has any issues? I guess it was thought it was done poorly or not.
These are dollars that were already appropriated that we already voted on.
Yeah.
And there was a glitch in the CARES 2 Act whereby the committee that vetted the applications made some mistakes.
No, absolutely not.
No.
That's not what happened.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry, but just on behalf of two of the members of that committee are sitting here.
Yeah.
So that's
do you want me to explain this?
We shouldn't let that stand.
Yeah, please.
Okay. So what happened is the legislative intent was very clear. The contract was very clear. And when it went into the process with USITA, the firewall that we had set up for the income levels were basically ignored. And so... small businesses were allowed to apply for and get through that process that we had already established, and there were awards that were made that should not have been made. But those contracts were executed, and what we talked about as a committee was that we should honor those contracts that were executed. So what these two resolutions do is basically separate the funds that were already allocated, already approved, into two categories. One, where the awardees actually did meet the LMI requirements, and one where the awardees did not meet the LMI requirements. That's all this does. The other thing that we did was we pulled two nonprofits that were awarded, and we put them over into the nonprofit awards bucket that we had already established. So we're just trying to clean up the problem that had happened and move forward with this. So that's what these resolutions do.
Ms. Emily?
The person that oversaw it is no longer employed with the county, right? That had a lot to do with this?
That's correct.
We just moved on. There were even quite a bit of applicants that were taken out initially by one person, right? Do we know if the point system that was recommended was followed? Do we care? It was $1 million. Does anybody care? We just move on.
So, I mean, I don't know if we can go to definitely here, but there was an extensive audit done that determined which applicants were selected that shouldn't have been selected. Okay, and so to your question, you know, the math has all been done, and the people who should have been, who had applications in already, are going to be made whole, right?
Yeah.
And then we're going to open it back up for the people who were excluded, to give them an opportunity to get what they should have gotten in the first place. The bottom line is that.
That's not correct.
Why would we ever do that?
That's not correct.
Wait a minute.
We have not decided to, because that would then mean that we'd have to go back into ARPA monies and we would have to allocate another X amount for folks who didn't actually
process. So you're right about that. Well, we are going to fix the people who applied and were eligible.
Everybody who got a contract is going to get paid.
Be made whole, whether
that's
they were eligible or not.
Correct.
Right? And so the problem, Joe, was that there was one of the criteria was removed from the formula to establish who was, eligible or not, and that was not known until afterwards, right?
And well, there were a lot of problems. I mean, I don't think we really had an asset test. I mean, there was quite a bit of problems. I mean, even people that technically were eligible that we're going to say feel good about giving them money at this point, when you go back and look at them, may not have really been what we had in mind.
But I think that you could say that for just about any of those grant programs.
There was a thorough process of looking at what happened. You know, the whole reason.
I don't know if you can call it.
Can you let me finish, please? Can you let me finish?
I interrupted while I still had the floor, but go ahead. You can interrupt.
You know what, Joe?
Go ahead. You got it. John, you got the gavel.
Well, I didn't hear you get interrupted, Joe. I'm sorry. I didn't know you. It sounded like you were done speaking.
Oh, okay.
And if you weren't, I'm sorry that I didn't catch that. If you want to finish what you were saying, then go right ahead, and we'll go back to Legislator Criswell.
Well, just I think we need to do a deeper dive into what the hell really happened. I mean, was somebody fired over this? I mean, maybe we can go to executive session and talk about it. How do we give away $1 million and have it go this badly? The EDA was very involved, and we still just keep pumping money into this EDA. It's just unbelievable. First of all, I said this was going to happen when we awarded the damn money. And now I'm sitting here going, I told you guys this was going to happen. Can we take a look back and figure out what happened? Are we allowed to know whether there was malfeasance here? Or are we allowed to find out? Are we even allowed to know if a major department head that seems to be involved in so many of these different things, and I have other issues with that person that I'll be talking about soon, if they were let go? Should we be investigating this? Should we pass this along to somewhere? You're talking about millions of dollars. Where there was absolutely no process, and it seems people that are involved, big donors, got money they shouldn't have. The whole process that we fought was getting passed off to the, do we even know if the EDA, before we give more money to the EDA, do we even know if the EDA followed the recommendations of the mysterious six or seven people that were supposed to be making the recommendations? Do we know that we're now acknowledging that the people that were people told to go away that shouldn't have been, and other people that should have been told to go away weren't? But nobody cares. It's not your money. If it was your $1 million, we sure as hell will be finding out what happened to it. But it's the taxpayer, so we don't care.
Is it okay?
Yeah, so that's just, you know, blatantly not true. There's been a very in-depth audit done that has pinpointed exactly where the issues were. And it's been addressed, and you know, well, it has been. You know, it was an error in whether it was intentional or unintentional. No one can speak to that. But there was an error in the spreadsheet. So there was an error. Okay. So there was an error in the spreadsheet that caused that particular income equation to be removed, and so that is what the problem was. Now, both USEDA board and this legislator approved one thing. What was applied is something completely different. So it wasn't like there wasn't oversight, because we're not going to sit there and monitor the operation of the county. It was discovered. There's been audits done by both the comptroller, and we're going to have an external audit in USEDA to verify everything, right? And it's been, we're taking steps to fix it. As we sit here today, there's active steps to fix what happened there, right? I mean, I don't know what your some of the accusations about people, you know, being favors and all that other stuff, and contributions or whatever.
Legislator Maloney.
Point of order. He just said I said favors. I did not.
Well, whatever. Whatever.
Let's talk over him.
Gentlemen.
Yeah. So you insinuate. Legislator
Cale, address it through me.
Okay. So through the chair, you know, there was an insinuation made that there was some kind of nefarious thing that took place, and there's absolutely zero evidence of that. There's zero evidence of that. None. There was what we have evidence of is a misapplied formula to the application. That's what we have evidence of. Both from the comptroller's office acknowledged that, and internally to USEDA, right? And you know, quite frankly, you know, at the time that happened, so much that was going on in that office, right? One person was maybe shouldn't have delegated some of that responsibility a little more than they did. I won't deny that, but that's what happened, right?
Yeah, and I just want to make the point that the people who sat on the committee, I mean, it almost sounded like an allegation was made about the mysterious group that sat on the committee. The people that sat on the award committee were not actually utilizing any formula. Like, they weren't applying a formula. They were scoring the sheets based on, and two of them are sitting here, based on parameters that were before them. So I just feel like it's very a lot of allegations were just thrown out. But
can you name one specific one?
When you give your turn, you can ask that question.
Yeah, I never be allowed to talk that.
Yeah. So the matter of fact is, again, I just want to reiterate that for the people who sat on the committee, those people were ranking applications before them. Part of the problem was that some of the applications before them were ineligible at the point that they were even before them. So
Yeah, there is a lot to say about it. I'm not happy about it. I didn't support this resolution when it came before us. I didn't support the CARES 2 funding, and it's painful to me that this is the way it came out. But we also have contracts with all of these awardees, and that's a painful thing to acknowledge.
Legislator Nolan.
Yes, I'd just like to underscore that when the problem was that a line of a criteria, part of an equation, got left out, that's a very fair error. It applies to everybody. It applied to everybody who tried to be a part of this process. It is an error that had exactly the opposite effect of what this money was trying to do. So it wasn't without its harmful effect, but it wasn't. It wasn't directed at any particular applicant or favoring any particular applicant or group of applicants except by the income criteria of the business.
Mr. Roberts?
Thank you. As many of you know, I sat on the committee with yourself. And were you on it, Pete?
I was not.
Who were you with?
Chris,
yeah. And, the three of us didn't have a lot of control over the situation. It was more or less, dictated to us how it was going to go. We had a little bit of say in the formula, what the weight, how they got picked, but it seemed like everybody that was picked was already picked ahead of time. There was no geographical balance in that, as we had stressed that, there was also nonprofits that received money. I did not think nonprofits, and I know you were, against that too, and I think the chair was. To me, to fix the problem is to eliminate, revoke the contracts on people that got the money that shouldn't have gotten the money, and have other recipients that should have got the money get it.
Were scores changed? Yes. Were people called women that weren't women owned businesses? Were not-for-profits things that were never supposed to be granted? Yes. Were some of them big donors? Yes. Did someone involved in the process who wasn't really involved in the process the way he was supposed to just say that it seems that some of these businesses seemed to be settled beforehand? Yes. Did the person that was set to oversee it just quickly leave county employed? Yes. Do we have emails that we've all gotten today or supposed to have gotten coming from former county employees talking about them blowing the whistle, going to Tim Wiederman and the deputy executive at the time with concerns, being ignored? Yes, we have all those things. Did I use the language that was put forth a minute ago? No. Does anyone here besides me want to look into this further? No. No, apparently not. Is there enough to look into? Absolutely. How do you make sure things like this don't happen again? You really take a deep dive. Not a comptroller's report that accurately points out one kind of unbelievable mistake after another. If somebody could be that inept, it's kind of hard to believe, but if that's what it was, ineptness, you have the EDA involved with a lot of other questions about the EDA, the CARES funding, payments for the East Campus, High Park, not shown at West Campus, financials not being seen from 2021 on, and we just keep going down this road. Nothing to see here, no problem, we don't care why that person's not employed here anymore. It will just throw them under the bus in the paper. Goodbye. Nothing else to see. Nobody else was involved. Nobody else was at fault. Not the person who oversees him that's supposed to be overseeing some of this. It ends with him. It'll never happen again. All right. That's what you guys want. Fine. It's not what I want. It's not why I became a legislator. But nothing here to see.
Deputy Secretary Lau.
From spending a lot of time with the data, as far as the information that we have available.
Deputy Secretary, can you speak up a little bit?
There were just a very, very hard look. There was a data-driven look at what was, what happened between the contract and the awards. And we did find, as is reflected in the comptroller's report series, I would say about two major process errors. And truly, these contracts are about honoring the awards that were made. And part of that is a calculus about what would be entailed in breaking contracts for businesses that received executed awards with the county for a scope of work on a reimbursement contract
where they've spent money and worked toward that. So it's that's part of the decision making here as far as these resolutions. There were errors, but there's also a kind of a reality of having executed contracts and what legislators Roberts or, you know, and I've heard it from some others as well, what would be the implications of breaking those contracts?
Every one of these businesses did prove that they were harmed by COVID. That to me was the bottom line. That's what you all were analyzing when you were analyzing it. Did they suffer from the COVID epidemic? And that was my understanding. That was the intention, for sure, for the ARPA committee and for the ARPA committee to say yes to this funding. And again, that was my understanding of that, that all the businesses, whether they actually met that LMI or not, were affected. And so I do feel like the ARPA money is going towards helping those businesses who suffered due to the pandemic.
I'd just like to follow up on that. There was a couple of nonprofits that may or may not have. I could take one entity into your hometown, I'm not going to mention their name, that could probably raise $35,000 by sending out a fundraising letter and instead of getting hard-earned money that we're allocating.
Every person in the world was affected by COVID, so I don't know what that generic affected by COVID necessarily means. It was meant to be. We were told it was going to be low-income businesses affected by COVID. We didn't apply any of the filters the way they were supposed to be, and it appears the business were picked before you guys were even doing all that work.
And it's a stretch to say they were affected. A lot of people wanted the money to hire employees for future, not recover anything from the past, to grow their businesses, not to out-recover. Any other discussion? All right, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. 438. Have a motion?
Make a motion.
Second? Second?
Second.
Second, Chris. All discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Carry. 439. Okay.
I'll make a motion.
Discussion?
On 437?
We did that.
Okay.
439 for discussion. Second?
I'll second that.
The county exec has asked for postponement 1 week, but just
no, it's just we knew this was coming. I knew it was coming. Everybody, these are coming, and the idea that the leases aren't coming through, the private leases we were promised, largely because it's a mess over there, still aren't coming in, and so we're going to fill it up with a bunch of government leases and hoping the other ones follow.
So, as someone who's been on USITA from the inception of many of the Enterprise East, West, 600, or I-Part, I'm very proud of it, legislatively. I'm extremely proud of my participation in any effort to revitalize I-Part, the old Enterprise West. So, you have your opinion about it, I have mine, okay? And here's what I want to say about that. From the very, very first discussion, we have talked about bringing county operations, specifically economic development and related departments, to that facility from the very first meeting I attended, right? And that was over 2 years ago. And here we are. We're now at a place where we can actually fulfill what we had planned on doing back then, and there it's going to really benefit not just, you know, I-Park, the developer, it's going to benefit the county. It's going to benefit the entire county. It's going to raise the tax base. It's going to create jobs, right? It's going to, well, it is. You know, it is going to create jobs. Us helping the companies coming in there, right, by training the employees that they're going to be need to hire that do not exist today. The training that they'll need doesn't exist today. Working with them, working with our local community college, our state university, right, the IDA and other agencies, right, will help us revitalize that site even further than we have, right? And you know, I go by there every day, and as somebody who went by it, you know, for my entire life, and then to see what it is today compared to what it was a year ago, right, it's unbelievable the transition that's taking place in that facility right now. And my neighbors tell me how proud they are that I represent them, and I fight for that place so much because it is going to bring jobs in, and what we do in this legislature to support that over the long term
is going to benefit every resident of this county eventually, every single one of them, because it's going to bring better jobs, higher paying jobs. It's going to increase the tax base around the town that I represent, and that, of course, means the school taxes and the county taxes, right? And so for me, anything that we can do to help that site grow, anything that we can do to help bring industry and create jobs is something that we should be doing. Thank you.
State Controller has put a lot out over the years about public beneficiary corporations not just being used to be go-rounds, but that's exactly what this is here. It's a go-around. We can't enter the 10-year lease, so we enter a lease for 5 years. At the very least, over the next week, can we have some proper whereases that describe what is actually happening with this resolution? Because the reason we're entering a lease with the EDA is because we're not legally allowed to as a government. That should bring pause. So why do we have these restrictions when we're just going to go get around it with the EDA that's performed so great over the years for us? But can we at least get some whereases? And that's something that I hope, John, you work on when we get resolutions. It's not Vicky's job to make sure the resolution is readable to our citizens and actually represents what's actually happening. But certainly in the whereases, there should be some descriptions of why we're entering into a sublease agreement with the EDA. I think that's a fair request. That's because we can't enter into the lease ourselves. We have to enter into the lease because I-Corp cannot borrow and get money unless they have 10-year leases. They want to borrow against these leases. They're having problems getting enough of the leases they want, the private ones that we thought were going to hold, that were going to come flowing in. So now we need to quickly get a bunch of these government leases in there so they can get some money flowing, hopefully do some things, and then get those private leases. Unfortunately, I believe going into the future, we'll realize that I've gone along. A lot of these buildings need to be taken down. But we'll see if this works. We'll see if filling a bunch of government square footage up there gets us where we need to be. But at the very least, can the resolution represent the people, the average citizen? There's people that think this is so great, at least they can read the resolution and know what's going on. Because if you read that resolution right now, you can't tell what we're doing. And the citizen should be able to read resolutions and understand what it is we're doing.
Mr. Petit.
Thank you. And to follow up on working with UC in the future, they need to be more forthcoming with their finances, and we should be able to have our financial analysts keep an eye as well as our controller. I would have liked to, or would like to see something within this resolution that they provide a monthly financial statement.
All right, Mr. Rock.
So just real quick to legislative. So there's a monthly financial statement at every UC meeting. Every UC meeting, there's a monthly financial statement.
Who's that forwarded to?
It's a public record for UC to board meeting. I mean, I don't think it's forwarded to anyone. It's just like any other meeting where meeting documents are posted for that meeting.
I believe those also get listed in the agendas for each month's meetings.
Mr. Rock?
I make a motion we postpone this for a week.
Second. Discussion.
Aye.
In favor?
Aye.
I'm going to take a couple out of order here. 454. Can I have a motion?
I'll move it.
Second.
This is your stuff, Undersheriff.
Yeah.
I'm trying to do you a solid here.
Call him.
Yes.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Okay. 456. Can I have a motion?
I'll move it.
Second.
Second.
Approval? Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carrie?
You know on that? It's Mike Hopko.
Right. Yeah, took me out of order here. 457, can I motion?
I'll move it for discussion.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carrie?
Is that all? The Polygraph, the Nycomco, and the Axion?
Yes.
All right. Have a great night.
Thank you for your patience.
I didn't realize Dave came.
I saw him sitting down there. I'm like, how far back in the agenda?
We're only four resolutions
this time. A fascinating night for you, right?
He lives closer to here than me, but
that was good.
Which one are you talking about?
Part of the attachments were the partners or shareholders or whatever the LLC disclosed. Sorry, I'm
we just passed that last month, didn't we? Was it the last month or the month before?
I was just wondering, because we had asked a couple of weeks ago or last month when we were told that purchasing was working on it. Is there a way to get it? I mean, how long before we start to see that policy being?
I can get an update from Ed. I'll email him right now.
Okay, thank you. All right, 440, can I have a motion?
I'll move it.
Second?
I'll second.
Discussion? All those in favor?
Is he here?
No, is he here?
No.
Hey, left.
I don't know. Please. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Okay. Should we get him? Yeah. Come to the next meeting. Okay.
Do you want to go get him off to work? Can someone?
I don't know.
Abe, is he here?
He was just
yeah,
he was
here.
There.
Can you see him?
He's in the other room. You want me to get him?
Yeah.
I mean, the room was filled up with people who didn't need to be there.
And here's at 3:30. Welcome. He might have quit.
Exactly.
I'm not going to not vote for
this one.
Exactly. Sure, why not? Sure.
There's actually two there.
Sign them both.
This is the committee of personnel, though. Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
I think that what you're thinking is just showing you that is that.
Yeah, they're not for this month. There isn't any.
How about for the last month?
No.
Okay.
This one we have, I think, for July. I mean, July. We discussed it today. They're all screwed up. Right? They're trying to catch up. They're trying to catch up. Because we're doing it through the bucket off.
The vending machine downstairs.
San Francisco is called.
Fair enough.
All those in, all right, so back to Route 440. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So carried. 441, can I have a motion?
I'll move it.
Second.
Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. 442, can I have a motion?
I'll move it.
Second.
Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So carried. 443, can I have a motion?
Moved.
Second.
Second.
Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Carried. 444, can I have a motion?
I'll move it.
Second?
Second.
Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
446.
I'll move it.
Second?
Second.
Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
I'm going to be a no.
Yeah. Just pass. 448. Can I have a motion?
I'll move it.
Second?
Second.
Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. 449. Can I have a motion?
I'll move it. Second.
Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. 451. Can I have a motion?
I'll move it.
Second?
Second.
Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Can I vote twice yes on that?
Yeah. Three times, yeah.
452. Can I have a motion?
I'll move it.
Second?
Second.
Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Skipping down to 458.
I'll move it.
Second?
Second.
Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Carried. 459.
I'll move it.
Second?
Second.
Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Four.
I have a question on that. What happened to the previous salary study?
This is the one.
Same one?
This is the one.
It's the only one.
It's the only one. I thought we did one like 2 years ago.
We did a management study internally.
Yeah, last year.
I mean, Joe did a resolution 2 years ago.
No, but they did hire a firm and then...
Oh, that
the
Evergreen?
The contract that was in play.
It was Evergreen. Yeah, that was...
Are we going to follow through on this?
Maybe. We'll see.
That was a long time ago.
County Executive is 100% committed. We expect it to finish in January.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Carried. 460. Can I have a motion?
Make a motion.
Second.
Second.
Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Carried. 467.
Move it. I'll move it. Second.
Discussion?
Yeah. Okay, this is the one, this is prohibiting online auctions.
Yeah.
Oops, sorry.
Yeah. I mean, given what's going on with the SCOTUS decision, I mean, who knows how this is going to move, but I'm sure that everybody saw the, or maybe everybody didn't see, the memo from the comptroller which largely was about the iPark occupancy in Yesida, also touched on this. And I, with no offense to the sponsor, I tend to agree with the comptroller. You know, the idea that we were conducting these auctions in a sort of antiquated way that required an actual movement of cash or certified checks. I mean, I think the intent, the idea that having an in-person auction would result in more local owners purchasing the property than an online auction, and more, in an ideal world, more, you know, first-time owners.
Again?
It's not the reality. You know, these auctions are, you know, they're prohibitive. Only certain kinds of people can participate, given the restrictions, given that ultimately it's a cash sale, given that you have to come, especially in the in-person auctions, you have to come prepared to leave with a percentage of a bid that you don't yet know what it's going to be. So you either have to come with a for real bag of cash or a certified check that's going to exceed the number. So I think that the online auctions are actually, it's not even that they're the future, they're the past, and we just weren't on board. Like, that's the way that all our neighboring counties have done it. So I definitely don't feel comfortable prohibiting online auctions, because I think that if, to the extent that we're going to auction properties, which ideally, you know, will not be the case, you know, we'll find higher and better uses, but again, the SCOTUS decision makes that, you know, all of this questionable, but I don't support this as written currently.
Especially in morning.
I happen to agree. I think that when you're buying a piece of property sight unseen, you have to have cash to do it. It's not like there's going to be a lot of first-time homeowners. I think if a group from New York City wants to come and they'll send somebody to the in-person anyways. I don't think this achieves what it wants to achieve, and I think we're just losing competition. And there's I don't know how anybody thinks about it, but the elderly or disabled individuals that may not necessarily be able to be in person. You know, I know some people that are pretty financially and pretty active in the private sector that are, you know, in wheelchairs or whatnot, and I think this gives access to them where they wouldn't otherwise. So I think there's other repercussions that come from this, but I don't see it helping first-time homeowners.
Yeah, I went down the road a couple of years ago. A legislator, you should tell, and I actually had this conversation a couple times about trying to figure out a way to put together some sort of a point system to prioritize folks who are local, prioritize first-time homeowners, prioritize women, you know, kind of looking at folks who might not have this opportunity. And so when we looked at this a couple of years ago, we're looking at a program that was down in Newburgh, which since then was found to be illegal. You know, the Fair Housing Act, it's complicated. And so I've actually asked our attorney to look into this again to see if there's been any updates on this, because I think if there's some way that we could figure out a system that would still be fair and still be legal, but somehow prioritize folks who we would like to prioritize in our region, I think it would be worth trying to look at and see if we can somehow do that in our auctions here. So I will update you after Mr. Grucci and I have further conversations about what he's researched and let you know about that program.
Well, there's definitely a way, and that way, the demonstrated way is the land bank. but right now, the land bank, because of the SCOTUS decision, is really, all land banks are at risk, because designating highest and best use, I mean, the best examples of land banks have the exact kind of programs that you're talking about, where they're dedicating to first-time owners, they're dedicating to adjacent or neighborhood owners, they're dedicating to, you know, it's you can do a tremendous amount, but we may not get that opportunity given both the far-reaching impacts of the SCOTUS decision, but also the lack of clarity on the SCOTUS decision. I mean, I don't know, Deputy Executive LaValle, left, but I had extensive conversations. Oh, she's down there. Okay, I didn't see you.
You're very quiet.
But I know we had extensive conversations about how there isn't yet, and I don't know if something's changed since we last talked, a lot of clarity on how that decision is going to impact, which is why we've held back on our, even on our auction. But, yeah, again, and to Legislator Maloney's response to my response about it being generally a cash sale, I mean, these auctions full out and flatly are cash sales. There, you can't get a mortgage if you bid on, if you're at an auction and you are the prevailing bidder. There's no time to get an auction. It's a cash sale, full stop. So, I mean, to the extent that you don't have to hand them green money, but it can be a certified check, but it's money coming right out of your bank. So,
yeah.
I mean, I know it's interesting to me, too, having been here for a long time, and I'm sure others who've been here for a long time would see it. It's a known group of players that come to these in-person auctions. It's the same people, and I'm not going to say their names out loud, but I saw the same names. I'm signing documents now that I saw those names 20 years ago. It takes a certain wherewithal in terms of financial wherewithal to come to these auctions. So again, I really do appreciate the intent, but I just don't think that this would achieve that. And I'm hopeful that we'll find a path with the land bank or something similar to really think about highest and best use, which is talking about what you're saying and what this intends in terms of getting it to people that really need it, but that remains to be seen. But if we're going to sell the property, I think online is already the reality.
So on the foreclosure process, we're in a holding pattern. There was a bill that passed the Senate and Assembly. It has not been sent to the governor for a signature yet, so I inquired as to why not. But this would place a moratorium on foreclosure actions pending new state laws being developed to deal with the Hennepin decision. It's a massive decision because this is how the counties operate. The most substantial portion of that decision is anything in excess of what is owed should go back to settle the lien, settle the debts, go back to the original owner. There's questions about, so other states that were not doing this process, they can charge an administrative fee because there is a process by which we don't go after liens and all of those other different parts. All liens currently in New York State law are extinguished upon a county taking. So this is an entirely new process. We are told that if we chose to go forward now, any excess proceeds would have to go into an escrow account. We haven't leaned into that because we know that this bill is passed and is pending signature from the governor. But it hasn't been sent, which means it's not on her desk even signed yet, so I'm kind of waiting for that part. So that's kind of where we are right now. It is a big wait and see. In the meantime, we'll continue to pile up properties in some senses.
So we could foreclose as long as anything beyond what they owe us is put into an account, and because if it does go through, we have to give them the money back in theory?
In theory,
The excess beyond what they are in.
Except that if we schedule an auction today and the governor signs a bill tomorrow, it's a moot point.
Yeah, we have to cancel the auction.
Yeah.
Sounds like a policy decision to me, though. I'd like the legislature to be in on that, whether we move forward and take the chance and set up. But it seems to me it's a conversation we should be having. But I'm just one of those policy guys.
That's it, Rock.
I appreciate you, dude. What they owe us is their entire back tax bill, correct? So that would include
penalties.
That would include anything that we've already made the school districts and the towns hold for.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I just also wanted to be clear that like there's a distinction between there's nothing stopping us from foreclosing. It's the question of auction and or other disposition because the Hennepin decision spoke to excess monies as being a taking, and where, from my perception, where it gets super complicated, it has to do with extinguishing the lien, not so much. It seems pretty straightforward in terms of selling for an excess. That's really the crux of the decision. It's just the decision had very, very, very broad impacts in terms of those lien extinguishing, and that's where I see, that's where it's very hard for me to wrap my head around, and I see a lot of complication coming in. So,
just curious, are we in touch with the Albany Land Bank, which seems to have been very successful about sort of where they're at right now?
I have not spoken to them.
It'd be interesting to reach out to them.
So we've spoken to some of the, not the Albany Land Bank specifically, but some of the land bank people, and they've indicated that they're pushing back on some of the state legislation, which is the moratorium on some of the ability to auction, and trying to figure out how they're going to operate relative to that. And you have other issues here as well, because you do have properties, for example, that have heirs that you don't know where they are. So you have those issues as well that are coming into play, some of the properties. So that's complicated.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the other things that I've spoken to Deputy County Executive about, I mean, again, in the Hennepin decision where, you know, there was X amount of back taxes and it was sold for X amount more, that more was considered a taking that should have been returned to the homeowner. But where I think it gets more complicated is when, if you're selling the property or transferring the property for less than its assessed value, would we have to satisfy the assessed value or the amount we sold it for? Like, there are no answers to any of these questions. Again, the cleanest answer that I can see is, if you sell it at an auction and it gets X amount more, that money goes back to the homeowner or set to satisfy the liens. But I think very quickly after that it gets super complicated.
Ms. Serna?
Thank you. The fact that the state is now contemplating possibly major changes to real property law, land use law, I think that's what I'm hearing from the administration. I believe that we in the legislature would do well to follow that very closely.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I just wanted to say I appreciate all of your conversation and all of your comments. Obviously, the impetus of this resolution was one tool that we may have access to help slow outside investment. So Clerk Easter sent me some information earlier today, which states that in 2022, a third of the auction bids were from outside of the county. And we all know that a majority of the Airbnb and Vrbo and blah, 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 blah is coming from outside investors. And not even just outside of our county, but like across the country, right? National corporations that are just coming in because the online auction has made it so much easier for them to do so. I agree, it's not a perfect system online or in person, but the in-person does really help to slow. There's problems with that too. If we have the same 40 people in the room, that's a problem. What can we do about it? Let's try to address it. I would love to see more data. I would love for this resolution to at least give us more data before COVID, during COVID. I want to know LLCs that we're buying, where were they registered? I want to know all of that stuff, because is it causation or is it correlation? What do we have? Do we have housing stock? Can we use this as a tool? This is like the whole point of me putting this resolution out there. So I really appreciate your comments, but if we're going to talk about a housing crisis, we have to use every single tool in our toolkit to try to help.
So I'll go to you in a second, but I'm going to speak for the first time here. So something that Legislator Cale said earlier, when we were talking about the impact for the additional tax for transfer, is you can't use the past couple of years, and you can't. And I think even looking at that for this resolution holds true. This area became wildly sought after, so whether it was an online auction or we had it in person, I think you're still going to see the interest that we've seen in this county. It exploded. I don't think having it online versus in person, having myself been to the county auction, the first time I went to one of those, and I saw all the deputy sheriffs that were there, and I had no idea why they were all there until I found out, because there are people carrying some very large sums of cash on them And I mean, we're talking about a room full of, I just did some quick math one time, and I'm looking, and I count, there has to be over $1 million sitting in that room in cash. I think doing it online, you also open it up to not only disabled people, people have a hard time getting there, but also just the working, average working person, giving up the day of work, which when I went, I did. I gave up a day of work to go to the auction, just to sit there and not know if you're going to get it or not. But if with the online platform, it's just like eBay, you can do a you can do your at your highest bid and let it bid for you. I don't see the, I understand what you're trying to accomplish. I just don't believe that this necessarily does. I think this does more harm than good. Chair Patel.
Yeah.
All right. Any other discussion? All those in favor? Opposed? Motion to defeat. 471. Can I have a motion?
I'll move it.
Second?
No second.
Discussion?
Just my only discussion is that I feel bad for whoever has to deal with the EMC. But whoever that is, God bless them. Chris, let him know. My apologies.
My only question is, does he usually do the 27th or 28th of July? I'm hoping this is...
There was an extension on several of the grant categories that were actually water-related, so that communities that might have suffered from
All those in favor?
Yeah.
Mr. Lynch.
Hello.
So we've already approved
Welcome
you.
Welcome back.
Yeah. But if you just want to introduce yourself and a little bit about you. And
yeah. Good evening, everyone. My name is Kevin Lynch. I'm up to be the next economic development director. Just very quickly, my background is clean energy, investment banking. My prior career, I should say, prior position was the director of clean energy for the New Jersey Economic Development Authority.
That's
enough. And helping him reduce GHG emissions in the state of New Jersey. Also, I was responsible for offshore wind, forested, and developing that program, also electrification. Prior to that, I've been in investment banking, working with local communities, M&T Bank during the COVID crisis, helping small businesses in terms of their loans and forgiveness loans, but also capital planning, you know, working with large infrastructure businesses. I've also been an entrepreneur. I was in Cincinnati where I built a factory for Procter & Gamble. I was making acquisition layer for Pampers and tampons, but the reason behind that was for workforce development and really being impactful in local communities in Cincinnati. I'm a New Yorker. I went to school in Rochester at RIT and did my grad work at RPI, even did legislative work in Albany and working at the DOB as well. Currently, I live in Forest Hills, but this has always been a favorite place of mine. Everywhere I went, I've taken this picture of the Catskills because I knew there's only one place where I wanted to be in the world, but only two places. Santa Fe, New Mexico. Santa Fe's too hot. So, not that this is my second choice, this has always been my first choice. It's unfortunate because, you know, when I was thinking of moving up here, there weren't any careers that could support, you know, the type of livelihood that I was looking for at that age. But even now, as I see the transition with demographics, the housing crisis, clean energy, jobs, I mean, just the other day I was talking to a family of four who couldn't find housing and they grew up here. And I sat there with them for about 2 hours talking to them about how they've been jumping from social service agency, from county to county to county. And one of the things that, you know, I'm really concerned about, at least I will certainly be involved in, is looking at the housing crisis. You know, bringing in my private partners and looking at P3 opportunities. Also with the investment bank line, looking at CRA opportunities where we can start really getting the private sector involved in this crisis in this county. Clean energy is always going to be a pet peeve of mine. And whether it's electrification, whether it's looking at hydrogen or other types of clean tech. RPI is certainly looking at seeding companies where we can really kind of engage and be collaborative around small businesses and, you know, kind of clean tech industries which can be supportive of economic development. So it's a lot to do, but I'm happy to be home. And certainly, if you have any questions for me, I'm always available to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
There is some portion of resolution.
I move we adjourn.
Oh, sorry.
Alicia?
No, I don't
have anything. Thank you.
In our packet, I gotta pull back up, we get this master budget of 701 grant and the master budget of Enterprise West. Can I ask, and I think I've asked before, it just hasn't been reflected, rather than just having an aggregate number, can you put the last month's spending?
Because I just looked at it and it looks like a different tab.
701 grant. Different tab?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I didn't see. Both of them have a monthly.
Yeah, I'll check the PDF maybe in the one tab.
Okay. When I looked on here, there was only one tab. When I looked on it, there was just the one tab.
Amanda.
There's
tabs. Okay.
And then there was a running total. Also,
how do you feel that we've stopped that since we don't own it anymore? Yeah.
We can.
I mean, I would say, right? You know, so we don't need any more tabs.
Okay, so we'll continue. I'll double check on the 701.
Okay.
Running
yeah, they're saying it's there. I just didn't.
Okay, I thought it was.
When I download it, now I see it as other tabs.
Yeah. It's there in the tabs.
But when I pulled it up, it's
getting late for you. Much here, man.
Motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Second. Second. I'm just glad enough to be here. So it's your tick number. North of Jack.
That was a Freudian slip. So I read my note here for both phones. We both agreed.
Favorite post. Okay, thank you.